So let's see. So, you know, I wanted to begin this time. At the beginning of this course, I was going to, I had told myself I was going to do a Beyond the Standard Model course that didn't discuss the hierarchy problem, except for the way I mentioned it early in the class, which is kind of, you know, the clear thing to say is that if someone only knew about the standard model, they would think there was this one mass scale in nature, the electroweak scale, and then suddenly when you told them there was gravity, they would be shocked by how big and how small the coefficients in front of the curvature term was on the one hand, and that cosmological constant term, the volume term, on the other hand. But I wasn't going to talk about arguments for why from a QFT standpoint the electroweak scale and the Higgs quadratic self-coupling is unstable, and because people have historically used that as an argument for why there should be new states seen at the LHC, and I've never felt as comfortable about that argument, and then no new states were seen at the LHC, and so I thought maybe best to just pass over it. Having said that, after I did mention it in the previous lecture and then did a bad job of explaining it when questions came up, I feel I should at least do a better job and clear things up. So I just want to briefly do that at the start of the lecture. So let's revisit what we were saying yesterday about Wilson's approach to effective field theory in the renormalization group. So, you know, again, so Wilson wants us to think about the path integral in Euclidean space and in momentum space, where you write the measure in momentum space rather than real space, and so then it's some path integral over all field configurations for all Fourier modes less than some cutoff lambda of e to the minus the action at lambda of phi. Okay, and now let's just be a little bit more explicit about what the action is. So let's say that it's, let's just focus for simplicity on a scalar field here. So there's the kinetic term for the scalar field, the ordinary kinetic term. And then there's all the other terms we can write down. So we can make any dimension, any operator with mass dimension, any operator O sub I with the mass dimension D sub I. And so this is some function of the field and its derivatives. And in fact, let's say that it has mass dimension d sub I. This is some polynomial in the field and its derivatives. Some monomial in the field and its derivatives. And let's imagine that it has ni copies of the field itself. So it might have it. So the ni might not be equal to di because there might also be some derivatives in there. Okay, and then it'll be convenient to write this thing now as, instead of times a dimensionful coefficient, let's pull so the dimensions of this coefficient now have to be d minus the dimension of this, because the total term has to have mass dimension d, so that when we, this is the Lagrangian. So when we integrate this Lagrangian over dx to the d, when we integrate it over space, we'll get something that's the action that's dimensionless or has units of h bar. So this has to have dimensions like that, and then we can have some dimensionless coefficient here, gi of lambda. Okay, and so then now, again, what we want to do is split the integral into a part, that's below an even lower cutoff. So let's split the field up like this. Okay, so in Fourier space, we would write this thing as and let's just split this thing up into, okay, where in this integral, what this cutoff means is that phi actually only has, the integral is not over all p, but only over p whose absolute value is less than lambda. And let's split this into two pieces. The part of the integral that runs over p less than a lower lambda prime. And then the rest. Okay, and let's call this guy, now I have to be careful not to screw up my notation, but so far I've been writing curly phi. Let me call this guy non-curly phi of x, so that part of the field. And I'll call this thing something else, chi. Okay. And so then, like we were saying before, the measure that we wrote before, d curly phi, is really just a product of d phi for all of the Fourier modes. And so in particular, it's a product of the d phis for non-curly phi and the d phis for chi. So the measure breaks up like that. And so we can rewrite this integral as d non-curly phi. So that's the part of the integral that runs over p less than lambda prime. And d chi of p to the this thing. Where now this is s lambda as a function of non-curly phi plus chi, just because of that splitting. Okay, and so like we said last time, we want to just define this thing to be e to the minus s of lambda prime, the effective action at lambda prime, as a function of not curly phi. So this we'll just integrate out the chi field, the field whose momentum modes are above our new cutoff, and define that integral as e to the minus the new effective action for the non-integrated out part, non-curly phi. Now, but alternatively, we can rewrite this. Another thing we can do here is we can take this function. Okay, and so now if you just think about this, so this is integral over space of this thing. So if every time we have a curly phi here, we just plug in non-curly phi plus chi, well, one thing we can do is we can subtract out all the terms that only depend on not curly phi. So here we would get a term which is d mu of not curly phi squared, and then plus some other stuff. And for example, if we had a phi to the fourth term here, we would get a term which is not curly phi to the fourth with the same coefficient, plus some other stuff. We would get terms that are like phi cubed times chi and phi squared times chi squared, et cetera. So let's split it up like that. So the first term that only depends on phi is exactly this same function, but now just a function of not, but now as evaluated at the argument not curly phi. Okay, and then there's everything else. Let's call that s. Let's call the everything else less s lambda hat, which is a function of both phi and chi, right? This one's a function of only not curly phi because that's exactly what the definition is. I've just pulled out all the terms that are only a function of not curly phi. And again, that's the exact same function as this one, but evaluated at a different argument. And then there's everything else, which depends on both fields. Okay, so then we can pull, since this thing doesn't depend on chi, we can just pull it through this integral. And so we can write this as d not curly phi of e to the minus s lambda of not curly phi times the path integral over chi of e to the minus everything else of phi and chi. And then this thing we can define as e to the minus delta s sub lambda of not curly phi, right? After we integrate out chi, this thing will only depend on phi, and we'll define that as e to the delta s. And so if you just compare this expression to this expression, you see that the relationship between the new effective action at the new cutoff lambda prime as a function of the field that only goes up to that lower cutoff is equal to this part, the old function of lambda, but now evaluated at the new, not curly field phi, and then plus the correction piece that comes from the integral integrating out chi. Okay, so now this initial action we had written down, the idea is this was we had written down all terms we could consistent with whatever symmetries there are in the problem and with certain coefficients, and the exact same numerical values of those coefficients appear in this part of the function. But now, well, by symmetry, the same sorts of terms will appear here, but with new coefficients. So when we re-expand this thing, so in other words, we'll get the old when we write this, we'll get an expression that looks like that, but the coefficients will be shifted because we'll get the old coefficients coming from here plus corrections to the old coefficients coming from here. Okay, so in general, we'll get something that looks like instead of 1/2 times partial phi, in general, this term times partial phi squared, in general, this term will get a correction, so it'll be some new coefficient z over 2, where z is the so-called wave function renormalization. And then we'll get the rest of the terms. And now it's convenient to write the rest of the terms as follows. Let me write them as, okay, sorry, let me make some space for myself here. Let me write the rest of the terms as sum over I of now lambda prime d minus di times z to the ni over 2. Remember, ni was the number of phi's appearing in this term, number of factors of phi appearing in this term, times gi of lambda prime times oi, which is now, you know, a function. The same expression oi as before, except now it's a function of not curly phi and its derivatives. And then, okay, then let's just, to get rid of all of these z's, I've included a power of z to the ni over 2 over here so that if we now just redefine curly phi to be z to the 1/2 times not curly phi, then we can make all the z's go away in this expression and get back to an expression that looks formally just like our previous expression. with curly fies. And with lambda replaced by lambda prime. Okay, and so that's just to say that after we suck out the wave function renormalization, that what's happening is that the new effective action, like we were saying yesterday, is looks the effective action at the higher cutoff looks just like the effective action at the lower cutoff, except in this way of writing it, all the lambdas have been replaced by lambda primes, including the explicit lambdas, which appear here and here, but also the implicit lambdas, which describe the fact that the dimensionless coefficients appearing here can have run to a different value over here. And now, front one is stuck. Okay. So now the point is, so we've written z in two different ways now. We wrote it in terms of this expression, in terms of an integral up to lambda, but now we've written it in terms of a formally identical expression in terms of the integral up to lambda prime. But it's the exact same integral. We've just manipulated it to write it in two different ways. So it had better be the case that, so that's just to say the value, because we're just taking the same expression for the partition function, the path integral, and writing it in two different ways, that function can't actually depend on the cutoff we use. Okay, and so in particular, it has to, so sorry, if we write lambda d, if we take lambda d lambda of this thing, well, there's, this thing depends on lambda in several ways. It depends explicitly on lambda, because lambda is appearing as the, in the cutoff there. It depends explicitly on lambda, because lambda is appearing in the action here explicitly. And then it also depends on it implicitly through GI. So we really have, using the chain rule here, we have two sorts of terms. We have a dd lambda term at constant gi, and then we have a term which is like d dgi d lambda d dgi. And when we apply this to the path integral, this has to be zero. And so this is an equation. This is the so-called Kalin-Simancic equation for the path integral, which is supposed to tell us how changing the cutoff at which the path integral is defined causes the couplings to flow in order to ensure that these two things, you know, because there's some change due to this term in changing the explicit value of lambda that appears. In order to cancel that off, to make the whole thing zero, these coefficients, these beta functions, have to be non-zero in such a way that this term cancels that. Okay, so now if we think about it, well, there's two sorts of explicit lambda dependences, and it's convenient to think about canceling those separately. Okay, so there's, when we take dd lambda, the derivative with respect to the explicit lambda dependence up there, well, there's one contribution that comes from dd lambda acting on the explicit lambdas that appear in the action. And you know, because each term in the action appears with a lambda to the d minus di, to cancel that piece, we have to have a piece over here that we cancel that piece by exactly having a term in the coupling that goes like the opposite of that derivative. So it will go like di minus d times gi. Okay, so if you think about it, yeah, that applying that derivative to that Lagrangian will exactly cancel the dd lambda acting on the explicit powers of lambda here. But and then there's the extra derivative of the Lagrangian, the extra change coming from the actual change in the cutoff by an amount d lambda. In other words, the change in this. And that is some, that's the quantum part of the beta function. Okay, that's the extra, whatever this thing needs to be. This is whatever it is, in order to cancel the part purely from including more or more or less quantum modes in the path integral. Okay, so if you want, you can think of this as the classical part of the beta function, the part just due to dimensional analysis. And then this is a sort of small correction, at least when h bar is small, coming from the extra quantum corrections needed. So let's focus for a second just on the classical part. So let's ignore the quantum part for a second. So what the classical part, well, we can, this says, if we just rearrange this, so this says dg d log lambda equals some constant times g. Let's divide g by both sides and multiply both sides by d log lambda. So this would become d log gi equals di minus d log d log lambda. And so if we integrate this thing, the solution is just gi over, let's say, gi in the UV is equal to, so let's integrate and then exponentiate. So that when you do that, it's equal to lambda over lambda UV to the DI minus D. And so in other words, if this classical beta function was all there was, you can check that what this is saying is that we could just take every time in our effective action we had a lambda to the D minus DI times GI at lambda, we could just replace, that's just equal to lambda UV to the D minus DI GI lambda UV. And then, because there are really quantum corrections in the game, there's some delta G quantum here, delta G GI due to the fact that we've ignored the extra part of the beta function coming from the quantum corrections. Okay. And so if you want, the one way to say what the hierarchy problem is that, you know, there's a term in the standard model, there's this one dimensional coefficient in the standard model, which in this language looks like lambda I squared times GI times the operator H dagger H. Where, okay, this is just now in this language, if this is the Lagrangian at the electroweak scale, this is lambda electroweak TeV squared, and this is some dimensionless coefficient to get the right mass. Well, okay, this turns out to be of order a tenth, now we know experimentally. Of order a tenth squared. But the point is that if we rewrite this thing as lambda UV squared times GI in the UV, let's say what the corresponding coupling constant was up at the gut scale, and then plus some quantum corrections. You know, the question is why this coupling is much, much smaller than this one. Whether this was zero or non-zero, it's puzzling to see why the quantum corrections in this way of looking at things, it seems like the quantum corrections as you flow down from the UV to the IR need to cancel off this, if you want classical or bare piece, to get a tiny ratio that brings lambda UV down to lambda electroweak. So that's the actual models that kind of bears out that if your picture of things is that you just start with a Lagrangian that seems to have reasonable size couplings at a very high scale, and then you actually, honest to God, do the proper running down to small scales, you get the coefficient in front here being much huger than this. It doesn't, the relevant couplings don't also get small as you go to the UV on the as you go to the IR. On the contrary, they get big. They become bigger and bigger relative to the IR scale you're working at. In other words, they stay up at the gut scale. So that's if you want the hierarchy problem explained a little bit more coherently than I did last time. Anyway, the whole thing doesn't rub me the right way. Like the whole topic doesn't feel like a kind of clean explanation where you say, that clearly is the, here's a problem and okay, here's the solution, or here's a direct contradiction between this and that. There's nothing with quite that quality here. And so anyway, I'm never totally comfortable with this whole topic, but any case, that's the hierarchy problem as people normally understand it. Many people thought that this was, that there was sure to be something, some new states at the electroweak scale, in order to avoid this problem, in order to stabilize the low scale against quantum corrections. So far, none have been found. It looks maybe worryingly likely that nothing like that will be found, although it's always possible. But anyway, for what it's worth, that's that. So let's see. So now I wanted to say a couple of other things while we're on the topic of running couplings. First of all, should we take a break? Maybe we should take a short break. Anything? I remember one time when I was a kid. Now this is even going back further. Here I must have been two or something like that, or maybe no. It's hard to. It seems like I must have been two, which is that we our cat. I have this vivid image that I reached for him. And I thought I was being nice, but anyway, he got up on his hind legs and kind of got in boxer stance, and then gave me a direct punch to the face, and I was very terrified. Anyway, we became good friends later, but I have this very vivid image still. Is that enough? Are we reset? You ready to go? Yeah. See, I'm worried that maybe I'm the only one who actually needs resetting, and you guys are just humoring me about this, but I have heard it's true, though. I've heard it's you're supposed to do something rather than just drone on for an hour straight. Okay. So, now, I wanted to say something to make sure. So in the tutorial today, one of the things, is this still the case? Well, one of the things that you'll be checking is about the checking the gauge coupling unification. And the starting point is this famous formula for which, again, I'm quoting without derivation, although I, of course, encourage you all to, if you haven't seen this in a QFT course, this is derived nicely in Peskin and Schroeder or in Weinberg's QFT book. It's worth doing, but that the beta function for gauge coupling I is given by some expression. So this is the term coming from the gauge boson talking to itself, and it depends on this so-called quadratic Casimir, which in practice for SUN, I will just quote here that this thing is just N in the normal and standard convention. And then times the number of scalars, times the number of complex scalar fields, times T of RS. So, okay, so this is T of RS here is the, is this, if the scalars we're talking about live in this normal, live in some representation where the corresponding generators of that irreducible representation are normalized, of that representation are normalized like T of RS delta AB. That's what RS is. So, and same thing for the now I'm about to write a fermion term where it's T of R fermion, and then that would just be the for the same thing for the fermionic representation. So in practice, we are always using in the standard model and in the extensions that that in the MSSM, and one is always working with in the examples that we're always looking at. We're always looking at things that live in the fundamental representation, whereas we've already been doing in this course, the T here is 1/2. So the fundamental for things in the fundamental representation, T of R will be 1/2 for us. And then minus 4/3 times the number of Dirac fermions. If you're dealing with a Majorana fermion or a Weyl fermion, a left-handed or right-handed fermion, which has only half the number of degrees of freedom, then this 4/3 should be a 2/3 times T, corresponding T for that representation. So I just wanted to illustrate so that one is on the same page. I wanted to illustrate how to get the right number here for a couple of examples, so that when you do the MSSM case in the tutorial, you don't get confused. So let's do two example cases. Let's do the standard model for the SU3 gauge coupling. So then we have 11/3 times SU3 for SU3. C2 is 3, so that's 11/3 times 3. No scalars couple to SU3 in the standard model, so there's nothing here. And then here we have quarks that couple to SU3. How many of them? Well, if you depends. So let's think in terms of the Weyl spinners in the standard model. There's two ways to think about it. After spontaneous symmetry breaking, we saw that the left-handed and right-handed down quarks pair up into a single Dirac fermion, and the left-handed and right-handed up quarks pair up into a single Dirac fermion. So in that way of looking at it, you can count it whichever way. Let's work with Dirac fermions. We would have 4/3 because we have a Dirac fermion. T, because all of these things live in the fundamental representation of SU3, is 1/2. And then how many are there total where there's an up and a down, which is 2. And then there's three families of those. Okay, so if I haven't screwed this up, that's 11. That is minus 4, so this whole thing is 7. So this is 7. So this thing, which we were calling B in the previous lecture, is minus 7 for QCD in the standard model. Okay, and now just to, so that's, that example should be enough to get you through all of the non-abelian groups. Now it's just a, I should clarify something in the abelian case. So what, let's do U1 in the standard model. We have to be careful applying this formula in U1. Okay, so again, this is a sum over all the different fields that couple to this gauge boson. Well, in the abelian case, U1 does not couple to itself. Or in other words, in the case of, remember, SU1 is not the same as U1. So in the n equals 1 case, in the U1 case, this is zero. That's what I'm trying to say. The photon does not couple to itself. Okay, so we get a zero there. And these guys, again, these are the trace of a square of the appropriate generator. So previously we were talking about these non-abelian generators, which we, in the fundamental representation, we normalized to be orthogonal with an coefficient 1/2, but here what we're really talking about is the trace of the hypercharge operator squared. So in other words, so how many complex scalar fields, I should have said, here, just like over here, when we had a normal Dirac fermion, we have a 4/3 here. If we talk about a Majorana or a Weyl fermion, which each have half the number of degrees of freedom, we should change that into 2/3. Similarly here, this is the right coefficient for every complex scalar field, but if you have a real scalar field which has half the number of degrees of freedom, that should be half, so that should be 1/6. But anyway, so in the standard model, what do we have? Well, the Higgs doublet has two complex, it's a two-component vector with two complex scalar fields. So we have minus 1/3 times 2, and then okay, each of those scalar fields has hypercharge 1/2. So we have 1/2 squared, because this is the quadratic. This is the trace of the square of the generator. So 1/2 squared, and then again there's two scalar fields. So that generator acting on those two scalar fields is like this. The two, if you think of it acting on the two scalar components of the Higgs doublet, it looks like this. So we square it, we get a quarter plus a quarter is, so in other words, we have 1/2 squared, but then times 2 is 1/2. Okay, and then minus 4/3. Oh, sorry, now, okay, so now for hypercharge, the left and right-handed fermions act differently, so we have to use the coefficient for a Weyl fermion, 2/3. Okay, so what are the available, what are the fermions and their hypercharges? Well, there's the Q left, so its hypercharge is 1/6, so we have that squared, and then times what? Well, how many of them are, there's three colors times two SU2 components worth of that, so there's 6 of those, and then there'll be three families for everything, so I'm going to wait and multiply by 3 in a moment. So in a single family, we get 1/6 squared times 6. And then for the up quark, we have 2/3 squared times 3 colors and only one SU2 component, so 3. Plus for the down quark, we have minus 1/3 squared times 3 again. And then for the left-handed lepton, we have minus 1/2 squared times 2 SU2 parts, no colors. And then for the electron, we have minus 1 squared, and then there's no colors, no SU2. And then again, we have to multiply this all by three families. Okay, and then, So now, let's see if I did this correctly. So this is minus a, so this whole thing is minus a third. And then here we have minus 2/3 times 3 is 2. And then what is this? 1/6. Plus 4/3 plus 1/3 plus 1/2 plus 1. And so this is 1/6 plus 8/6 is 14, is 9 plus 11/6 is 11, 14. Plus 6/6 is 20. So this is, sorry, so this is, am I doing,
why the Higgs has 2 multiplied by 2?
Why does the Higgs have a 2?
Like for the Higgs contribution, you multiply it by 2 twice.
Oh, that's a good point. Why did I do the second times 2? Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you. So yeah, this is just there's 2 of these scalars. Each of them has a half. Thank you. So this gives a 1/6. And then the rest of this, if I haven't screwed up my algebra, gives a minus 40 over 6. So the whole thing is, anyway, the whole thing is minus 41 over 6 times minus is equal to 41 over 6 times g cubed. Okay, so sorry for the, I know it's a bit of a, just want to make sure we're on the same page about calculating for, because to be able to do the exercise later today. But okay, so that's how that formula works. Again, I know it's a bit of a, if you haven't derived it before, it's a bit of a black box formula. But we don't, we can't derive it here. Okay, now in the last few minutes, I wanted to just take, while we're discussing renormalization group stuff, you know, there's a bunch of other interesting things to say about, hints about the standard model when you talk about renormalization group. Okay, so remember that in the previous lecture we had defined the fine structure constant alpha I associated with a given gauge coupling to be gi squared over 4 pi. And then we showed that the renormalization group equation had this general structure that alpha I inverse, in other words, 1 over alpha I, at a given scale lambda, was equal to alpha I inverse at the Z mass. Minus bi over 2 pi log lambda over mz. Oops, you know, I remember I want, there's something I wanted to explain over here, which is that this B1, I just calculated 41 over 6. The B1 that we used in the formula the other day, and the B1 that you will use to get the gauge couplings to unify in the MSSM, well, so the B1 here is, we just got 41 over 6. In the previous lecture, I said 41 over 10. What's going on with that? Why is there this difference in a factor of 3/5 between the answer we got today and the answer we used yesterday? So it's worth explaining that. It's worth explaining that briefly. And then I'll get back to the subsequent discussion. Okay, so what's going on here? So what's going on is the following. In the standard model, we had our covariant derivatives, and they involved, it was partial mu, and then we were adding all the different all of the relevant gauge boson terms for whatever field we were acting on. And in particular, we were always adding I times gauge coupling G1 times the hypercharge of that field times the corresponding gauge boson B mu. Now, in grand unification, okay, so this matrix here is the hypercharge matrix as we ordinarily defined it. So if it's acting on, if you think of this covariant derivative as acting on the tower of all the standard model fields, this is some diagonal matrix that acts on that tower, and its values are 1/6, 1/6, etc. You know, 2/3 for the up quark, etc. That's how we normalize things. That's the standard normalization for the standard model. Okay, so here in grand unification, we have instead the gauge coupling. The covariant derivative looks like some. Let's say for SU5. Let's talk about SU5 for a second. It's the coupling constant for SU5, G5, times the generators for SU5. These are 5x5 traceless Hermitian matrices times the corresponding gauge bosons for SU5. Let's call those XA mu. And remember that the idea was we were going to take these generators. We took these 5x5 generators and we broke them into. So in the previous time we talked about it, we were actually not talking about the generators. We were talking about the group elements themselves. We were exponentiating these generators, and we were getting a U2, a unitary matrix here, and a U3 here, and then hypercharges multiplying the hypercharges we were treating as phases here that were like alpha cubed and alpha to the minus 2 down here. If we work instead in terms of the generators, if we write this thing as the identity plus some I times some infinitesimal I times something for in the limit where all of these things are close to the identity, then this representation looks like, okay, we have the SU2 generators, which are things which are zero down here, and Hermitian 2x2 traceless Hermitian matrices up here. We have the SU3 generators, which are traceless anti-Hermitian matrices down here and zero up here. And then we have the hypercharge operator, which we fit in as something that was proportional to, proportional to something that looked that had coefficients, something that was proportional to 1/2, 1/2, minus 1/3, minus 1/3. Minus 1/3. Well, actually, let me change all the signs. So, in other words, this is the. Remember, this is traceless and Hermitian. This is the traceless and Hermitian generator. We wanted the traceless and Hermitian generator that commuted with the other two SU2 and SU3 generators we talked about. So, it's an identity matrix here and an identity matrix here. So it commutes, and we've normalized the two identity matrices so that the trace vanishes. Okay, so the normalization again is the normalization where the trace of TAB is equal to 1/2. So let's see if this thing. So this guy, remember, for example, when it acted on the 5, we had the two components of the left-handed lepton doublet up here, which, okay, do indeed have hypercharge minus 1/2. And we had the three components of the right-handed anti-down quark down here, which do indeed have hypercharge plus 1/3. Okay, so this would be this is the normal hypercharge matrix really appearing here. This is with the, this has currently the standard normalization it would have in the standard model. But does it satisfy this condition that the trace of it squared is equal to 1/2? Well, no, the trace of it squared is equal to 1/4 times 2 plus 1/9 times 3 is equal to 5/6. So in other words, so if we want this answer to equal this answer, well, we have to put an extra factor of 3/5, square root of 3/5, in front of that matrix, so that then here we would get a 3/5. So in other words, what the really correct normalized generator is square root of 3/5, because then we would take this whole thing and multiply it by 3/5, and we would get 1/2, which is correctly normalized. Okay, so if you think about it, if you just compare these two expressions, in other words, this t is really 3/5 times y. And so in order for these two expressions to be equal, g5 must be 5/3 times g1. So if you take this expression, what we had calculated was the renormalization group running of g1. If you just make this substitution and convert g1 into g5 using this equation, you'll see that all that changes is that this whole thing gets multiplied by 3/5, and so this becomes 41 over 10, which is the number that we had yesterday. So anyway, just wanted to make sure that was clear. And then now I finally want to briefly throw in my other remarks about the renormalization group and what hints they give about the standard model. Okay, so the renormalization group running was like this. And so we have this issue that if Bi is, if alpha starts, so if this is alpha I inverse, and this is lambda, and we start at the Z boson mass, some positive value here, then as lambda increases above the Z boson mass, if Bi is positive, this thing is a line with a downward slope, and at some value it crosses zero. But if alpha I inverse crosses zero, that means alpha I itself has blown up, has diverged to infinity. In other words, the gauge coupling Gi has diverged to infinity, so that's a so-called Landau pole. And so that would be a clear indication that your QFT has broken down, or has at least the perturbative has gone out of the perturbative regime for sure. And so there better be some new physics that comes in before you reach the scale lambda to cure the theory. So you might ask, if you look at all the different couplings in the standard model and you run them up to high scales, do any of them have Landau poles like this? Do any of the couplings diverge at high scales? And an interesting thing about the standard model is that no, none of them do until above the Planck scale. And once you get above the Planck scale, you really can't trust just these purely QFT calculations anyway. So it would have been a very interesting hint of beyond the standard model physics if there had been Landau poles unavoidably located below the Planck scale. That would have really said some new physics beyond gravity has to come into play before you get to Planck scale physics. But the standard model, it's a striking fact that the standard model does not seem to be like that. Now, one thing that does happen is that, so two couplings, you know, if you want, there are five most important couplings when you're talking about how the different parameters in the standard model run. There's the three gauge couplings we've already seen, and then there's the top quark Yukawa coupling, which is sometimes called H. And so let me use that notation here. So its beta function, so it has some calculated beta function, which is, okay, 1 over 16 pi squared. I just want to have it on the board so we can look at it here. Just want to qualitatively explain the idea. Times 8 times g3 squared h minus 9/4 g2 squared h minus 17/2 g1 squared h. And then there's the beta function for the quartic self-coupling of the Higgs. And it is, well, in view of time, actually, I'm not even going to write the whole thing down. I'll just write key term. Okay, I'll just write a couple of key terms here. So in particular, let's look at the terms that involve the let's forget about the gauge coupling terms and just look at the terms that involve the top quark Yukawa. So it turns out that because if you look at how these things run in the actual standard model, if you plot the top quark Yukawa, the top quark Yukawa is by far the biggest Yukawa coupling in the standard model. It turns out to be almost equal to 1 at the Z boson mass. Okay, so this is top quark Yukawa. And then it gets smaller as you run to higher scales, but doesn't reach 0 by the time you get to the Planck scale. Now, but because H is very big, this negative contribution to the beta function of lambda is very big. So lambda, as you run it to higher scales, it decreases. And, well, how much does it decrease by? It depends on what lambda is. Okay, so we didn't know what the value of lambda was until 2012 when the Higgs mass was measured. Turns out the Higgs mass, there's this famous expression relating the Higgs mass, Higgs boson mass, to the Yukawa coupling lambda. So as soon as the mass was measured at 126 GeV, that implied some particular value for lambda. And you could do this running to higher scales. And initially, what got a lot of attention is that if you run it, it actually seems to go negative well below the Planck scale. It goes negative at around 10 GeV, whereas the Planck scale is up here a billion times higher, 10 to the 19 GeV. So it has something where it goes negative. It doesn't go very negative, but it goes negative, and then it comes back up. So if that's right, what that is saying is that if you really take the standard model seriously up to the Planck scale, then the Higgs potential, which we normally think of as looking like this, in other words, it has a minus m squared h dagger h term, which causes the downward curve here, and then lambda phi to the fourth causes it to pick back up. The quartic term causes it to pick back up. Okay, but really, it turns out that the renormalization group improved potential, what really appears here is lambda as a function of the scale of the Higgs VEV, the thing that appears in the actual effective potential. And so if lambda really goes negative out at 10 to the 19 GeV, that means that this thing has a big bump. But then out at 10 to the 19 GeV, it becomes stupendously negative because, in other words, even though this becomes just a little bit negative because the field values out here are so much larger than the field values over here, there's the tiny minimum we know and love, but then there's a second much huger minimum we don't know and don't love. And what can happen is that means that the Higgs VEV that we live in right now, if that was true, would be metastable, and there would be some lifetime for a bubble of this true vacuum to form and expand and kill us all. Now, fortunately, it turns out that even if this is true, that the lifetime turns out to be long enough in the parameter region that we seem to be in, that it's considerably longer than the current age of the universe. But nevertheless, it's kind of a grim future. But the interesting thing is that it would seem to suggest that, you know, something beyond the standard model is going on below the Planck scale, where I include this sort of crazy negative minimum as beyond the standard model, something very unlike perturbative standard model physics we normally think about and thought about in the early universe would be going on way below the Planck scale. Now, it's important to say, though, that later analyses, this turns out to depend very sensitively on exactly what the top quark Yukawa is, and which in turn depends on measurements of the strong coupling, gauge coupling G3, and the quark structure functions. QCD is a very messy business. And so actually those, as those have crept down, it turns out the higher the top quark mass is, the earlier this thing goes negative. As those have crept down, this has crept up. And actually now, even though the best fit value maybe goes slightly negative, it's within one sigma error that it doesn't go negative. It actually just maybe becomes tangent. The striking thing about it is that it seems consistent that what it actually does is goes to zero at the Planck scale and becomes tangent and then rises again, which would be kind of a striking thing. And in fact, there was this famous paper before the Higgs mass discovery by Shaposhnikov and Vetterich where they did the opposite analysis. They said, oh, if the standard model is asymptotically free, that we could take as a boundary condition that the Higgs coupling and its beta function both vanish here at the Planck scale, and then we could use that to predict the Higgs boson and the Higgs boson mass and the top quark mass. Well, post-dict the top quark mass and predict the Higgs boson mass, and indeed, you get the right value for both of them. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say. That one of the striking features of the standard model is that if you follow the renormalization group up to one of the first maybe most striking thing is that the gauge couplings first seem to unify, and then seem to unify in the standard model, in the supersymmetric extension, but now no longer unify directly. Without supersymmetry. On the other hand, although they can unify if SO10 breaks through Patti Salam, which is something I'm not sure if I'll have time to explain this later, but without supersymmetry, actually, if SO10 goes through Patti Salam and then down to the standard model, the gauge couplings can still unify without supersymmetry. So that's my, I personally think that looks like the best gut at the moment, if you want to think that an honest-to-God four-dimensional gut is right. But anyway, that points to some very high, interesting scale, the gut scale, a little bit three orders of magnitude below the Planck scale. But the other competing thing is that the fact that there's no Landau poles and maybe this fact that everything about the standard model remains stable, perturbative, all the way up to the Planck scale. Maybe that is a hint telling us that despite what we think or want or wanted or thought, that maybe the standard model is right up to the Planck scale. There doesn't seem to be a clear definitive indication apart from kind of tuning arguments, which have a kind of fishy quality, that you really need new physics below the electroweak, below the Planck scale. Although there are still, that would then leave us still in a state of various puzzles about the standard model that we still don't have an interpretation for. That was my summary of the state of renormalization group flow of things in the standard model up to higher scales. That's it. Sorry, as always, for running over. Not as always. Sometimes I've been on time, but too many times I've run over by 5 minutes. So sorry about that. Any questions? Already busy thinking of your joke or poem for next time?
That's good.